are ethically challenged presidential nominees.
Trump decided to wage a shock and awe campaign against these people, many of whom were middle class and working class. And so he even went so far as to place ads in the newspaper offering homeless people a free place to stay in the Barbizon Plaza in the effort to terrorize the existing tenants into leaving.
That's Ted Rall. We talk with him about his new book, Trump. Then new revelations indicate serious conflicts of interest between Hillary Clinton's State Department and the Clinton Foundation.
There is a paper trail a mile long showing that the Clinton Foundation is not fundamentally a charitable enterprise. It is a political vehicle that allows donors, and of great concern, foreign donors, to curry favor with the Clintons. And this is a very powerful family. Bill Clinton is the former president. Hillary Clinton is very likely going to be a future president.
That's Ken Silverstein. We talk with him about his article for Harper's Magazine, Shaky Foundations. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. If you believe current forecasts, Donald Trump isn't all that likely to become president of the United States in November. But whatever happens on November 4th, Trump has changed the political landscape. Some see his rise as a sign of encroaching fascism, allowing extreme right-wing views about immigrants and Muslims to gain currency. But while Trump's message of hate and intolerance excites a portion of his base, is it really the main reason for his support? Or is it something else? Something that has more to do with the destruction of good union jobs and the disappearance of the middle class? My guest, cartoonist Ted Rall, has just come out with a kind of political biography of Trump the candidate. The book, Trump, is an antidote to the media's failure to understand what is really behind the Trump phenomenon and why it matters. Well, Ted Rall, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. It's great to be here.
This is your latest book, Trump, a graphic biography. The last time we talked, you said you were doing a series on people who changed the world for the better. There was Ed Snowden, Bernie Sanders, and an upcoming Pope Francis, which hasn't appeared yet. Is that correct?
It hasn't appeared, hasn't been done much except just some research.
So you did a bio of Donald Trump instead. Tell us why.
Well, he's changing the world to make it a better place. Well, at least that's what his followers think, and that's what he thinks. And, you know, maybe they're right. I personally don't think so. For me, this was a detour. Quite frankly, when the Trump phenomenon started last summer, I knew that he was going to be the nominee the second he announced, and I'm kind of surprised that no one else got it. Because to me, it was simple arithmetic. If you're running against more than a dozen other dudes and you have massive name recognition and you come out of the gate with 30% of the vote, it stands to reason that when you divide the remaining 70% of the vote 12 or 17 ways, that you're probably going to win. And so I realized just watching the pundits get it wrong just from day one and continuously throughout the entire cycle, I realized that I had a story to tell about this very well-documented guy that maybe others had not told. The Trump book is not comprehensive, doesn't pretend to be comprehensive, and could not be comprehensive unless I spent 2,000 pages on it, and who would want to read it? And I certainly wouldn't want to draw it. But this is more of an extended 200-page editorial cartoon about this guy and why he matters, why he's important. The politics that he represents are interesting and need to be understood in a better way than the pundit class, which has been letting us down just at an increasingly alarming rate. So I had a need to chime in.
I told Ted Rall about a story I'd heard about Terre Haute, Indiana, a place whose voters almost always pick the winning president. This year, pollsters are finding it's Trump, although Sanders also had a lot of support before he dropped out. Voters cited the fact that Terre Haute used to have good union jobs, and now they're gone. I asked Ted Rall about how the Trump phenomenon reflects the voters in Terre Haute.
Yeah, well, you know, it's if anybody's read my Bernie book or has certainly been following the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, they know there's a direct parallel here. On the Donald Trump phenomenon comes out of some of the same impulses as the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, but interpreted in a different way. And what it boils down to is a question of who's to blame. We all are familiar with the hollowing out of the middle class caused by increasing income inequality in the post-Vietnam War era over the last 50 years. And we all know what's happened to the formerly industrial cities of the Midwest, now called the Rust Belt, places like where I'm from, Dayton, Youngstown, Flint, Michigan, Detroit, and so on. And these places have been gutted. And so, you know, there's different political analyses within the mainstream two-party electoral process that take different takes on what exactly caused these this rising unemployment, the outsourcing of jobs, and so on. And, of course, the rise of a super-rich class at the expense of the middle class and increasing poverty throughout the country. On the left, the interpretation has been to blame the rich. And so that's where I am. That's where my sympathies lie. And the ruling classes, and that analysis is fairly straightforward, and it basically boils down to look to the powers that be and the controlling interests, and you know, people who are in charge are by definition in charge and therefore have the most control. And we look at the free trade agreements like NAFTA, WTO back in the 90s, and the GATT agreement and so on, and you can see some common threads between left and right, both progressives as well as members of the Tea Party on the right hate those agreements and hold them largely responsible for taking away American jobs and hurting the middle class. But where the right differs is that it taps more into the nativism and xenophobia that's always been part of American politics on the not just on the right, but mostly on the right. And so it comes down to, well, you know, foreigners are stealing our jobs. Now, Donald Trump has played the politics of nativism and isolationism since at least the 1980s. I can find evidence of him ranting about this stuff as early as the early 1980s, and I'm sure it goes back longer than that. This has clearly been his worldview all along, that America is no longer a country. It doesn't defend its borders. It's that we're allowing foreigners to come in and steal our jobs either by invading the country or by having companies outsource jobs overseas. And like a lot of analyses that are a little bit toxic, there's a little bit of truth to them. Certainly corporations have been outsourcing jobs. The problem with the attacking the illegal immigrants to the United States is one, first and foremost, of facts, which is to say that the net flow of immigration between the Mexico and the United States, which is the border we're all talking about, has been back towards Mexico for years. So it's almost like a 10-year-old story that people are reacting to. 10 years ago, the border was out of control. There were lots of Mexican and Central American nationals crossing the border in Texas and California and the Southwest, and certainly a lot of them ended up in the American workforce. And, you know, simple supply and demand obviously dictates that a higher workforce causes lower wages for everybody across the board. But that hasn't been true for a long time. The Obama administration has been obsessed with deportations. And also a lot of people who've come here have found it very difficult to find jobs. In fact, there's more jobs in Mexico than there are in the United States. But the facts don't really matter in politics. What matters is the resentment and how it's going to be expressed. So on the left, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and others were drawn to Senator Sanders because of his analysis that these free trade deals were out of control and had to stop, and that the super wealthy were taking more than their fair share of our national wealth, and that corporations have too much power over individuals and over the and too much influence on government, and that these are things that needed to change. On the right, Donald Trump used a series of dog whistles, and I would say in the most modern incarnation, started this with the birther, with joining the birther movement in 2010, 2011. Now, the birther movement was the movement that claimed that President Obama wasn't born in the United States and, in fact, is Muslim or was born in Kenya or somewhere else, and that he was not really born in Hawaii as he actually was. And so, you know, behind this, percolating just under the surface of this conspiracy theory is obviously a very kind of dark racism, no pun intended, that is, has been with us for a very long time. But by attaching himself to this very fringe political movement, this billionaire developer suddenly legitimized it. And that really excited the far right. The far right couldn't believe that this guy who has buildings named after him had legitimized them and their politics. And that's really how he jump-started his 2016 campaign. Now, although he had to really wait for the 2012 defeat of Mitt Romney in order to decide that he was going to run this time. But I think, you know, this is something that he'd been waiting for an opportunity to do for a long time.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ted Rall about his newest political graphic biography. It's called Trump. Now, the racism is an issue, and as you say, the roots of that come from the resentment of people having lost their jobs through the trade deals. But you also go back to the financial meltdown of 2008 and the whole housing market crash. You talk about two options that were available. One was a retail approach to bail out homeowners. And then there was the wholesale approach to bail out the banks. Of course, we know which one was taken. Explain those two approaches, and why do you think the latter one was taken, especially after the, you know, so-called progressive candidate Barack Obama came into office?
Yeah, well, so imagine yourself as the outgoing President Bush or incoming President Obama in 2008-2009, and you're dealing with this subprime mortgage meltdown. You've got hundreds of thousands of people losing their homes and their jobs every month. The unemployment rate is soaring. The underemployment rate is soaring. The stock markets are going crazy. The credit markets are completely screwed, and you don't know what to do. So the bankers come to you and say, look, there's basically two ways you can handle this. You can either give money to the distressed homeowners and renters and unemployed people. And what that will do is it will prop up the underpinnings of the entire financial markets. And here's how it's going to work. The subprime mortgages are based on mortgages that are themselves distressed. So if you can allow people to pay those mortgages, then the overlying securities are going to be stabilized and will retain their value or increase in value in the marketplace. Now, that requires a vast government effort, and it requires probably some additional bureaucracy in order to get those checks to where they need to go. You're talking about millions of Americans that need to be beneficiaries of a vast new government program, and it's difficult, it's complicated, and you want to make sure that there isn't too much fraud, otherwise it's not going to work. On the other hand, you can do what we ended up doing, which is to give trillions of dollars to the five or six largest mega banks and put the money directly in their pockets so that they can be safe from the effects of these collapsing securities, these monster subprime mortgage swaps, derivative swaps that they came up with themselves. And then the banks won't fail. And the advantage of that is it's really easy. You only have to make a few wire transfers, sign a few deals, shake a few hands. You don't have to set up any infrastructure. You don't have to hire anyone. It has a lot of disadvantages, though, and we're seeing the disadvantages of that decision now. The underlying economy still remains weak because high unemployment and low spending is not good for the consumer-based economy. It creates political instability, which you're seeing in this year's election cycle with the Bernie Sanders challenge to the once inevitable Hillary Clinton, and obviously to the hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Donald Trump, who, yeah, I think it's fair to say, is crazy. So you're seeing a lot of political instability. And it also doesn't even really work to prop up the credit markets, because the underlying mortgages still remain troubled. And the underlying securities markets are still weak. So it doesn't address the fundamentals, but it was fast and it was easy, and it should be noted that the people who were in the room, like Timothy Geithner, the secretary of the Treasury at the time, had very close ties to Wall Street, and so that's the solution they were pushing for. There was no one from Housing Works was in the room when President Obama was considering what to do, and so there was nobody. There were no advocates for ordinary working people, and so the results are completely predictable, and. The roots of this, you're seeing the collapse of the Republican Party, but you're also seeing the collapse of the Democratic Party. I mean, part of the story that nobody's talking about is that Secretary Clinton has voter approval ratings that are every bit as bad as Donald Trump's. So what you really have is an unpopularity contest between two candidates who are both hated, even within their own parties, and on both sides. Voters are going to go to the polls and hold their nose to vote against the side that they hate a little more. That's not a recipe for a healthy political system.
Yeah, you say that Trump is a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. How do you think the Republican Party goes forth? I mean, let's say Hillary Clinton wins, and I say that largely because she is the candidate of the corporate establishment, as we see with all the Republicans who, in fact, are flooding to her campaign and giving her lots of money, and of course with her choice of Mike Pence as her vice president. So, I mean, I'm going to assume that she's going to win just simply because she's the choice of the ruling classes. But nonetheless, this hostile takeover, that's going to have reverberations. I mean, does the Republican Party just go back to where it was?
No, I don't think it does. I think lessons are being learned by the Republican Party establishment now, and it's going to and the lessons may be learned in time to save the party in the long run. This may end up being like a Goldwater-type change where they have a devastating defeat that teaches them some things about their ideology that they didn't, and their supporters that they didn't know about before, or it may lead to a widening of the party of the political system to accommodate a third party like Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party, which is soaring in the polls these days. But there's no way to know how that's going to play out. I mean, certainly Donald Trump seems to be. It's Donald Trump's party, and even if he loses, his influence is going to go on for a long time, because he has taught not just the Republicans but also the Democrats that nobody likes these free trade agreements. They're really unpopular, and they were supported by the elites of both major parties for decades, unquestioningly, always voted past over by overwhelming margins, and it's got to shock the elites to learn that this thing that they were always in favor of, basically trickle-down economics, internationalism, globalization, is something that nobody likes.
Right. And now Trump, the TPP has, I mean, I think in some ways been the wings on which he's soared, although others would say it's his racism and the immigration issue, maybe the twin wings on which he's soared. But I agree with you that he may be crazy, I think he's been diagnosed as a malignant narcissist, and that seems pretty obvious. But he has some positions that, a lot of people can get behind who are even on the progressive left, not just the TPP, but also on military interventions, for example, Russia and China. And you go into that in your book. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny that Donald Trump has been attacked for essentially being in favor of doing of closer relations with Russia and Iran. And he keeps saying, well, quite reasonably, what's wrong with closer relations with Russia and Iran? I think most Americans think, most of us having spent our entire lives living in a state of virtually perpetual warfare, we have to ask ourselves, wouldn't it be great to get along with other countries, especially powerful ones that could kill us and actually hurt us? This seems like common sense. Donald Trump isn't a pacifist. He talks about bombing the blankety-blank out of ISIS. So he's into that. He talks a lot about how our military is so-called depleted and needs to be restored. This has no basis, in fact, whatsoever. But with those caveats aside, he is definitely to the left of the Democratic Party when it comes to foreign policy. This is a guy who repeatedly talks about how he opposes the invasion of Iraq. I say opposes because he didn't really oppose it at the time. Now, retroactively, he says he opposed it. At the time, he had given some interviews, I believe, to Howard Stern, where he said he was in favor of it. But that sort of doesn't matter. For a Republican to back away from a Republican war that was thought up by a Republican president, George W. Bush, is remarkable. And for him to be able to go to the Republican National Convention and sit through all those debates and tell Republican audiences that the war was a disaster and a mistake is remarkable. You can't even get Hillary Clinton to say that, but she voted for that war, and she's never really apologized for her vote or admitted it. So there's a lot to be attracted to. I mean, a lot of the policies, on, especially on trade and on foreign policy, I really agree with. You run into trouble, I think, with sort of the lack of care for ordinary people. But even there, Trump is interesting because, for example, he talks about getting rid of Obamacare as a disaster. I personally agree that it's been a disaster, probably not for the same reasons that he says so. But what's interesting is he talks about replacing it with something, another government program that presumably would be better. Republicans never talk about that. When Paul Ryan talked and Mitt Romney talked about getting rid of Obamacare, they didn't talk about replacing it with anything. And people can't get behind that because even though it's a crappy system, it is a system. And there was no system before. So people don't want to be thrown completely to the wolves. And Trump is smart enough to realize that.
Yeah, in some ways, basically what you're saying, or are you saying this, that Trump, while he may be to the right of certain positions in the Republican Party, and I'm not even sure about that, on immigration, but that he's actually to the left of the Republican Party.
Yeah, he's way to the left of the Republican Party on these issues. There's no question. He's also to the left of the Democratic Party on these issues that I just mentioned.
A lot of people say, and, you know, I think I tend to probably agree with them, that the notion of Donald Trump having his finger on the red button of nuclear warfare is a terrifying prospect. On the other hand, others point to the fact that Obama has recently authorized $1 trillion of spending on new nuclear weapons, small tactical nuclear weapons that are much more likely to be used, according to military commentators themselves. And some people, like Jeffrey Sachs, think that Hillary Clinton might actually be a danger with her finger on the red button. So I wonder if you could weigh in on this controversy.
Yeah, well, I do think Hillary Clinton is dangerous, albeit in a very different way. I think if I were advising Hillary Clinton, I'd say just keep pushing away on the temperament idea, because following 8 years of the very, very calm-seeming Barack Obama, calm-seeming, not really calm-acting, because you're talking about a guy who's been using drones to assassinate people like they're going out of style, but people are used to this, the president as being this calm-seeming, relaxed, cool, calm and collected dude. That's just not the case with Trump, and his temperament does seem jittery and wild and crazy, and people do worry about him waking up like the president in the dead zone in the middle of the night with a vision and starting a nuclear war for no reason. That is it's a concern, and I think, you know, you just have to wonder, is this a guy who would go off the rails? Maybe. It can be truly terrifying.
Now, moving to his biography, I'm not going to go into it in detail. We can let our readers do that with your excellent book, Trump, A Graphic Biography. But you cite Balzac. You say, behind every great fortune is a crime. And so this seems to be kind of one of the emblematic crimes of Donald Trump in his building of Trump Tower on the former Bonwit Teller site in Manhattan. Talk about that great crime that he committed there and really what it says about his position on immigration and other issues.
Well, you know, the Bonwit Teller department store went out of business back, I guess, in the late 70s, early 80s, and the building was empty. Donald Trump purchased it, and it was a beautiful Art Deco building whose details probably should have been preserved if the Department of Housing Preservation had done its job. But they didn't, and Trump demolished the building using illegal immigrants from Poland, oh, the irony, who were very underpaid. When I checked, they made about $5 an hour. Now, you might say, well, this was 1983. That was a lot of money back then. No, it wasn't. And the conditions were extremely brutal. They made so little money that they couldn't even afford to rent a room for the night. So a lot of these guys ended up sleeping on site, as they say. And it seems that a lot of building codes and basic the rules that govern safety rules were not observed. And there was a lawsuit filed by some of these Polish workers for unpaid wages to add insult to injury. So it was a hot mess. And, you know, that's not the only time. I mean, anyone who was in or around New York City in the early 80s remembers Trump's shenanigans when he purchased a building called Barbizon Plaza at 100 Central Park West, 100 Central Park South, with spectacular views of Central Park. There were a lot of rent-controlled and rent-stabilized tenants in that building at the time, some of whom were paying rents as low as $90 a month, and Trump's plan was to evict them and tear down the building and put up a high luxury high-rise condominium for wealthy people. He set out to evict them. Now, that's not an unusual story. A lot of landlords have done the same, but usually you end up having to buy out the tenants, bribe them to leave. Trump didn't want to do that. Trump decided to wage a shock and awe campaign against these people, and many of whom were middle class and working class because they'd been there so long. And so he even went so far as to place ads in the newspaper offering homeless people a free place to stay in the Barbizon Plaza in the effort to terrorize the existing tenants into leaving. That's the Donald Trump of the early 80s, the Donald Trump who was seen in the society pages squiring beautiful women to the hottest, swankiest clubs at night. But during the day and also at night, his goons were doing his work trying to terrorize his tenants. And just parenthetically, he had a tendency to lose a lot of these battles. Donald Trump was a thug and a bully, and people who stood up to him ended up usually prevailing, although it ruined their lives for a number of years. And then at the end of it all, Donald would act like, well, you know, can't blame me for trying, no harm, no foul. Some of these tenants report that he would run into them after bruising battles in landlord-tenant court, and he was very friendly and polite to them. He didn't seem to hold a grudge.
It's just business.
Just business.
So finally, let's get to the F word, fascism. Do you think Trump is a fascist?
No, I don't. And that's because it would be an insult to fascists. Fascism is a developed political philosophy. It has a coherent thread that Donald Trump doesn't have in his thinking. Donald Trump is more of an accidental authoritarian. That's the title of one of the chapters in my book. He's a guy who basically discovered by talking to crowds that certain lines get applause and certain lines don't. And he repeats the ones that get applause, and he stops repeating the ones that don't. That's his shtick. Now, when you're giving talks to right-wing audiences, the lines that get a lot of applause are those about throwing Mexicans out of the country, banning Muslims, cracking down on terrorism, and so on. And that's been the basis of his entire candidacy this cycle and his nomination. his authoritarian impulse is undeniable. His great interest in law and order, talks about it, thinks about it, cares about it. His obsession with first responders, the military, and how people must follow the rules. He is not about freedom. He is about control by the state. But he blundered into this ideology. It's not something that he thought about. He didn't read up on Marshal Pétain. He doesn't know who Tito was. He certainly didn't study the works of Hitler and Mussolini, although there are reports that he supposedly had a book of Hitler speeches by his bed. I think Ivana said that, but that may not have been true. And he says that he never read them, and I believe him. There's no indication that he reads books at all.
Mm-hmm. And yet, the machinery of authoritarianism has already been put in place long before Trump, should he become president, would be able to use it. And that machinery has been put into place basically since 2001.
That's right. I mean, you know, people forget that Bush is gone, but that Bush's works remain. And, for example, we never got habeas corpus back. The Military Commissions Act remains in force. The U.S. president, including President Obama, continue to assert the right to assassinate any American citizen, including with a drone, including on U.S. territory. That is a legal right of the president that they assert. I mean, it's not legal according to the Constitution, but the Constitution gets ignored a lot, as people in Guantanamo can attest.
Well, this has been a great conversation, as always, Ted Rall. Your latest graphic biography is Trump, and it's just a terrific read. I read it all in one sitting. Thanks so much for talking
with
us here.
Thank you so much.
Ted Rall. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interviews with him about his previous books, including his biographies of Edward Snowden and Bernie Sanders. Next up, the shaky ethical foundations of the Clinton Foundation. Stay tuned after the break.
George Washington was a white man. Adams and Jefferson, too. Abe Lincoln was a white man, probably. And William McKinley, the whitest of them all, shot down by an immigrant in Buffalo. And a star fell out of heaven. I'm dreaming of a white president, just like the ones we've always had. A real live white man who knows the score, how to handle money or start a war. Wouldn't even have to tell me what we were fighting for. He'd be the right man if he were everybody.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. New details emerged this week on the ties between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department during Hillary Clinton's tenure there. Details like this. At least 85 of the 154 non-governmental individuals who got access to then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton donated to the Clinton Foundation or promised to back its programs. As much as $156 million were donated, with at least 40 people donating more than $100,000 and 20 giving more than $1 million. That kind of money can buy an awful lot of access to jobs, to fat contracts, to influence. In his piece written for Harper's Magazine, Shaky Foundations, my guest investigative reporter Ken Silverstein says the Clinton's so-called charitable enterprise has served as a vehicle to launder money and enrich family friends. And Silverstein is no Hillary-bashing right-winger. But good journalism follows the money wherever it may lead, and Silverstein says all signs point to serious ethical violations by the person who could be the next president of the United States. Well, Ken Silverstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Now, this article that you wrote, Shaky Foundations, is about the Clinton Foundation, which has come under scrutiny, increasing scrutiny, it seems, in the last few days. In fact, there's some recent reports that the Justice Department, which failed to indict Hillary Clinton for Her carelessness with the emails is now looking into the Clinton Foundation. You write, if the Justice Department and law enforcement agencies do their jobs, the foundation will be closed, and its current and past trustees, who include Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton, will be indicted. That's pretty strong language. Why do you say that?
Because there is a paper trail a mile long showing that the Clinton Foundation is not fundamentally a charitable enterprise. It is a political vehicle that allows donors and increasing of great concern foreign donors to curry favor with the Clintons. And this is a very powerful family. Bill Clinton is the former president. Hillary Clinton is very possibly, likely going to be a future president. Foreign contributors, corporations, governments, rich individuals cannot contribute to U.S. political campaigns. But if you look closely at how the Clinton Foundation operates, you have to believe that when foreign contributors give money, frequently they are currying favor with the Clintons. And when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she took some very interesting steps that benefited some of the big donors to the Clinton Foundation. So that's A. Point B, we always have to hold this organization to the standard of a charity, which is what it claims to be. And especially when you're a former president and a potential future president, there should be a very, very high standard here. These are public officials. This is not just some schmo running a $20,000 little nonprofit group. This is a nonprofit charitable enterprise. So why is it that we find repeatedly that cronies of the Clinton family are being offered very high-paying salaries for consulting gigs or staff jobs at the Clinton Foundation? What are they actually doing for that money? You know, Sidney Blumenthal, one of the most vicious political hatchet men in modern U.S. history, a Clinton family bagman and hatchet man, was getting paid $10,000 a month for consulting work. And at the same time, he was bringing to Hillary Clinton's attention his business interest in Libya. That's a problem. Okay, so you've got that as point B. And point C, which I've already alluded to, is that you have donors to the foundation who Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, has helped out. Let me just give you an example. But she has taken steps that have very greatly benefited major Clinton Foundation donors. So, for example, in Colombia, Bill Clinton likes to fly around the world on the private plane of Frank Giustra, a Canadian. He's described typically as a mining magnate. He actually started off as a penny stock fraudster, and he got very rich, and he got a lot richer once he teamed up with Bill Clinton. Flew to Kazakhstan with Clinton. He flew to Colombia with Clinton. I think there were a few other stops along the way. And what typically happens, and to give you a specific case in Colombia, he flies down there. Bill and Frank fly down there in 2010. Bill meets with the president. I'm not sure if Juicer met with the president as well, but, you know, they were down there officially on Clinton Foundation business, you know, opening joint partnerships together, allegedly to help the poor people of Colombia. Well, in fact, Bill goes down there and meets with President Uribe, the former president, who I would say is easily the nastiest, worst human rights abusing president in modern Latin American history. Now, I could be wrong about that, but I know he's a top three or four for sure. Ties to death squads, very, very corrupt. So Bill and Frank Giustra go down there, and at the very same time, in fact, on the exact same day, Hillary Clinton is down there as Secretary of State, and she holds a press conference with Uribe. Now, this is a guy who's got a terrible record. A member of Congressman Jim McGovern's staff wrote Hillary Clinton a memo saying, whatever you do when you go to Colombia, don't suck up to Uribe. That's exactly what she does. She granted him an aura of legitimacy by standing next to him and talking about what a great partner he was. So they're all down there together, and soon afterwards, Frank Giustra gets some natural resource concessions in Colombia that make him even richer. I mean, you know, I'm not the FBI. I wish I had powers of subpoena. I wish I could interrogate witnesses. I wish I could compel people to testify. If I had those powers and I had a staff, I'm pretty damn sure I could compile a very strong case against the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton's actions as Secretary of State. And by the way, the U.S. State Department and OPIC, which is not a U.S., technically a U.S. government agency, I think it's quasi-public, but there's a lot of influence on the part of the State Department, by the State Department on OPIC. I think it's Overseas Private Investment Council. You know, the State Department and OPEC have gave money to Justra Enterprises. So it's just, this is low-hanging fruit. As a journalist, it's almost too easy.
Talk more about the Clinton-Justra Enterprise Partnership, the CGEP. You say that they've been moving significant sums of money into the Clinton Foundation's flagship office in New York. This is a Canadian charity. Talk about the significance of this route of money to Canada and then to New York.
Well, this is really a cesspool. I've mentioned Frank Justra. He and the Clinton Foundation have various joint enterprises. And Justra, I'm not sure he's still the biggest donor, but he used to be the biggest donor at he claims to have given $100 million. They formed this entity up in Canada, which is another, quote, charity, and there are joint partnerships in various countries between the CGEP and the Clinton Foundation. So in Canada, the nonprofits are even less scrutinized and regulated than they are here in the United States. And you can give money to Canadian nonprofits, and you don't have to disclose. There's a lot less disclosure to the public, but also to tax authorities. Here in the United States, if you donate money to a nonprofit, the nonprofit doesn't have to disclose it to the public, but they do have to send it to the IRS. And in Canada, there's a lot less disclosure. So what I've been told, and other people have reported on this as well, is that there's been a lot of money sent to the Clinton-Justra Enterprise Partnership in Canada, and we don't know the source of all that money. Justra refused to release the donors for a long, long time, and then he started releasing some of the names. But there still are a lot of people who gave to that entity. We don't know where the money came from. Then, and this looks very much like a money laundering racket, the Clinton-Justra Enterprise Partnership made large contributions to the Clinton Foundation in its name. Okay, so you have money going into Canada from unknown sources and then being sent to the Clinton Foundation in the United States under the name of a charity, the Clinton-Justra Enterprise Partnership. So it all looks perfectly cool and legal. There's no problem there, right? It's just that we don't really know the origin of the money that the Canadian entity was sending to the Clinton Foundation. If this was being done by criminals, you would immediately say, hey, they're laundering money, they're hiding money. I can't say that for certain, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about Justra himself. There was some kind of uranium mining deal?
Yeah, and this also deal clearly helped him arrange, although they both deny it. They get on a plane, they fly over to Kazakhstan. My recollection is they fly in, they arrive late one night, they leave the next day, but you know, around midnight or something, they have a meeting with the dictator of Kazakhstan, president for life, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who's ruled since the Soviet era, by the way, when Kazakhstan was a republic. And they have a meeting, and mysteriously afterwards, Frank Justra gets this big uranium concession. And Justra has a standard operating procedure. You know, he flies places with Bill Clinton. He has created a shell company. He gets a concession and he puts it into a shell company, and then he monetizes it on Canadian stock exchanges, which are also extraordinarily loosely regulated, even less regulated than U.S. markets. So it's always been sort of a Wild West in Canada. And so in this case, he got this uranium concession, put it into an unknown shell company. Industry observers, and Peter Singer wrote about this book in a book called Clinton Cash. He did a lot of the early work on this. And, you know, people say, oh, he's right wing. Well, you know what? Look at the facts. He documents very well what happened here. And others have as well. I mean, the New York Times has written about it. You know, I've written about it. Lots of people have written about this. But in any case, Justra, he sets up a shell company. Nobody's ever heard of it because he's just created it. And so suddenly this big, huge, huge concession that, you know, legitimate mining companies, well-known brand names were fighting for, and Justra gets it, puts it in a shell, monetizes it. I think it was on the Vancouver Exchange, which was the worst of the worst. They actually finally shut it down. But he puts a shell company on the exchange, This is typical. The price runs through the roof. He makes a lot of money. And then what he did in this case was he flipped the asset. He sold it off. You know, he bought, nobody knows exactly what he paid for it. We just know he got it in a late night deal with a dictator with Bill Clinton's help. Even though, again, they will both deny this, you know, I don't know that Jimmy Hoffa, the former Teamsters president, is dead either, but I'm pretty sure he is. You look at this case, it's the same sort of situation. There's no way that there's no connection between Frank Giustra getting this deal and Bill Clinton and Frank Giustra flying to meet with the dictator. At that time, Hillary Clinton was not Secretary of State, but she did. She was a soon-to-be senator from New York. I don't believe she had at the origins of this case, but Hillary Clinton, as a senator from New York, took some very, very interesting steps in regard to Kazakhstan that were very favorable to the regime there. So it's another example of Hillary, coddling dictators or, you know, horrible elected leaders, where there's an interest on the part of the Clinton Foundation.
And uranium mining, I mean, just talk just briefly about what the implications of that may be. I mean, uranium isn't that involved in the production of nuclear weapons?
Well, there have been all sorts of theories, and this I confess I cannot speak affirmatively about, but you can, you know, your listeners can read about this by doing a simple Google search. There's a lot of controversy about that part of the deal, and whether, you know, I mean, the Russians, I think, in the end obtain the concession. But what I will say is that Frank Giustra he's not just a mining magnate. He is a natural resource rape and pillage operator. He goes into countries, he gets concessions. Sometimes he flips them and somebody else does the raping and pillaging, but sometimes his own companies do it. This guy has a lousy track record. This is a major donor to this liberal Clinton Foundation. And they're always, you know, you go to the Clinton Foundation website or the Clinton Giustra Enterprise Partnership, and they talk about the wonderful work they're doing around the world. I can assure you, they are not doing wonderful work around the world. And when Frank Giustra gets a natural resource concession in a country run by a dictatorship or by a government like Uribe, trust me, he's not working on behalf of the Colombian people or the people of Kazakhstan. He is making a lot of money. And they're not protecting the environment. I mean, I love the way, you know, the Clintons and Giustra are always bragging. If you look at their self-promotion about, you know, their politically correct labor practices, their politically correct environmental practices, look around the world. That's not what they're doing.
Now, Ken Silverstein, talk a little bit more about the work of the Clinton Foundation. It's not just an issue of these kinds of deals that are being arranged for the donors, but also just the work itself, like in Haiti. And explain a little bit about how the Clinton Foundation works. It doesn't work like other charities. It kind of puts together deals that are supposed to then, you know, potentiate good works in the world.
Rolling Stone did a really good piece some years ago, and others have written about the Clinton Foundation's pathetic work in Haiti. I mean, it's really, really appalling, but I want to defer to others. I also want to give a shout out to Charles Ortel. He's a financial analyst who has done amazing work on the Clinton Foundation. He has a website. If you just do a Google search for his name, Ortel, O-R-T-E-L, you will find amazing reports. And he is, you know, he has described himself to me as an enemy of crony capitalism. He's not a fan of the Bushes or the Clintons. He's done tremendous work. And for people who really want to do a deep dive, I'd recommend that you go to his website. But I can tell you that from what I've seen, and I'm working on a story and I really don't want to discuss it too much, but from what I've seen personally, the Clinton Foundation, their efforts on the ground in some of the countries where they operate is really, really disgraceful. And you go to their website and what they say on their website does not match up with what you find on the ground. And again, you know, I've written, Google my name in the Clinton Foundation, and you'll find a lot of stuff. Look at for a story I wrote about HIV/AIDS and their efforts in that regard. And all I can tell you is they do a lot of self-promotion, a lot of congratulatory talk about all their amazing work to combat AIDS. And the numbers do not match up. Their story does not match up. And in this regard, it's interesting because in Kazakhstan, their alibi was when Clinton and Giustra went over there and mysteriously Giustra got this uranium concession, the alibi was, oh, you know, we were over there to discuss Clinton Foundation work on to fight AIDS in Kazakhstan. Well, AIDS is, of course, a really serious problem. But when they went over there, Kazakhstan was not a country that was, you know, that had a really high incidence of HIV/AIDS. I mean, it had a problem, but it was not like South Africa or other countries where it was just an absolute state of emergency. So I, you know, and I can't find a huge record of their success, you know, their work in Kazakhstan combating HIV/AIDS. So I don't think that alibi holds much water. I'd also note that I, as I've written about in various places, Ira Magaziner, former Clinton administration, Bill Clinton administration healthcare official, is involved in their HIV/AIDS programs. He's another total crony. And, you know, he's got a consulting shop up in Boston, and he's making money off of their HIV/AIDS program. And you know what? Check with the Clinton Foundation. I can't get them to ever answer any questions, but I would really love to see how much money they have received in their deep personal fight against HIV/AIDS and how much they have actually spent on it. As I recall, Elton John was supposed to receive an award from the Clinton Foundation, and he backed out of receiving that award. And I'm pretty sure it was because he was not pleased with what they were doing in their alleged effort to fight HIV/AIDS. So, you know, a lot of the questions you're asking me, I can't give you as specific an answer as you'd like, and that's because the Clinton Foundation isn't talking. They will not comment on these things unless they've got a friendly journalist who they know is going to write a nice piece, or if they absolutely have to, if it's a New York Times or the Washington Post, they can sometimes coerce comment out of them, but they are very tight-lipped with what they have to say.
Well, that brings in the whole question of auditing. You write in your piece, Shaky Foundations, the piece for Harper's Magazine, that the Clintons, you know, have an auditing firm, and you have a certain opinion about it. And then talk about the audit by PricewaterhouseCoopers.
For a long time, the Clinton Foundation was audited by a firm called BKD, this little firm in Little Rock, which is very suspicious. Makes you wonder if it was sort of a in-house sort of accounting firm, because accounting firms are supposed to be independent. You know, and that's actually, I just want to draw a parallel here with Bernie Madoff, because that's what he did. He had basically a friendly accountant who was supposed to be scrutinizing the books and wasn't at all. And it's a similar situation with the Clinton Foundation. In any case, BKD was replaced under pressure because the Clinton Foundation, their audits and their tax returns were just riddled with what basically were just minor little technical errors, in which if you go to Charles Ortel's website, you will find out that they were not little minor accounting errors. They were massive, massive irregularities in their statements. So under pressure, they agreed that they would do a full audit with, you know, somebody new. So they brought in PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is the accounting firm that was supposed to be auditing Enron, if people remember that one, that enormous company that went down the tubes. And PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is a very politically connected firm, came out and said, oh, yeah, we checked, and basically they said everything's fine, no problem. All I can tell you is I think Charles Ortel is a lot more independent than PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I have to recommend his work, because the Clinton Foundation from the very, very beginning has been incredibly opaque. It didn't start releasing donors until it was forced to. It hid its donors for years. It's still very opaque about them. You go to their website now, and they list their donors, and it looks like, great, wonderful, you know, we're disclosing information. But what they don't disclose, which is super important, is the dates of when they got contributions, for example. So you get these lump, like, million-dollar and up donors. Well, that's useful to know, but we don't get the dates of the contributions. I would really like to know, and, you know, this is a big entity, hundreds of millions of dollars raised, a very, very powerful political family, the potential future president of the United States. Politicians have to disclose their campaign donors and the date they got it. And you know what? That date is vital. Because you might figure out, oh, gee, you know, the next day, you know, Congressman Blank introduced a bill in favor of a donor. The date is vital. So they provide the minimal level of transparency after refusing to disclose donors at all, continue through entities like the Clinton Jewster Enterprise Partnership to shield donors, and then, you know, claim they're being as transparent as possible. It's just the way Hillary Clinton is running her presidential campaign. She's super transparent, super open. She just doesn't have press conferences or answer any questions. Now, let me say very clearly here, because this happens all the time, I don't like the Clintons. I'll be very honest about it. I also don't like Donald Trump, and I've written negatively about him as well. You know, I'm a journalist. I think of myself as being entirely independent, so I chase stories that I want to chase, and I follow them where they lead. And I like to write about Republicans. I like to write about Democrats. I don't really care. But, you know, the Clintons are constantly waving off their critics as, you know, a big right-wing conspiracy. There are a lot of people, honest people in the center and on the left, who are very critical of the Clinton Foundation as well. It is a shady enterprise. It does not pass the smell test in terms of its accounting work, in terms of its activities. And any serious investigative agency like the FBI should be able to nail them. And it's really a shame that James Comey, who's going to go down, this is going to be his legacy, the man who covered up for the Clinton Foundation. You know, he had a reputation for honesty and integrity, and he comes out and says, we're not going to investigate. There's just not enough evidence. And this is about so-called Servergate, but trust me, that is tied to the Clinton Foundation, because what they're hiding, why she set up a private server account, I can't state this with 100% authority, but all evidence suggests that they were seeking to protect information they didn't want released to the public, and they never thought these emails were going to get out. They were released under duress, and a lot of them have to do with Clinton Foundation business. And Comey let her off the hook, and he actually says, we're going to prosecute other people for doing the same thing, but in this case, we're not going to do it. You know, what sort of country do we live in? It's becoming increasingly clear. Powerful people play by one set of rules, and the rest of us, the 99% or the 99.5%, you know, we have to follow the rules. But the Clintons, they don't.
So one just last question. Hillary Clinton has said that if she's elected president, the Clinton Foundation will not accept foreign donations. Is that enough?
No, it's not enough. They should shut the foundation down. First off, in saying that they're going to no longer accept foreign donations, it's an admission that they shouldn't have to begin with. Just that they were able to get away with it for this long and taken God knows how many millions of dollars from the Saudis, the Qataris, and other foreign governments. I mean, by saying I'll no longer do it if I become president, it's an admission that as Secretary of State, they should not have been doing it. And the real blame here is with the Obama administration that allowed them to get away with it. Obama signed the administration signed a memorandum of understanding with the Clinton Foundation that allowed the Clinton Foundation to operate in this sleazy way while she was Secretary of State. So that's where the blame goes with Barack Obama. But beyond that, it is not enough. They should shut the foundation down until they prove that they can operate a charity and not a political vehicle. And again, saying we're not going to do it any longer, hey, it's a little bit too late for that. This foundation is about, you know, 15 years old. They should never have done it from the start. It's an admission of guilt.
Ken Silverstein. A longtime investigative journalist, Silverstein is a contributing writer for Vice and columnist for the New York Observer. He's got a great new blog, Washington Babylon, with shocking new stories and political sleaze. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. You'll also find a link to his article, Shaky Foundations, for Harper's Magazine. It appeared originally in November of 2015. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.